Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tomorrow, January 19th, the talented rapper and producer Mac Miller would have turned 30. By his mid-20s, he'd already released number one albums, received Grammy nominations, and produced music with the likes of Thundercat and Vince Staples. But unfortunately, he passed away in 2018 from an accidental overdose of what was called a mixed drug toxicity of cocaine, alcohol, and fentanyl. You may remember his NPR Tiny Desk concert, which was filmed about a month before he died.
And I can show you what it seems, what it is, what it truly might be. Nothing that you know of. You don't need to hold up, 'cause I'm so above and beyond. Take drugs to make it up, way up where we on. Space shuttle Elon, time we don't waste much. When we wake up, then I have her sang just like Celine Dion. Catch me if you can, but you never catch me, damn. Whole lot of yes I am, all the way in with no exit plan. Already left in the jet, don't land. Yeah, the time is ticking, come take a ride, get inside. This is highly different, I'm talking fly, got a pilot with him, yeah. Can't mind my business, why you tripping? Give you something that your eyes can witness. Ooh, you're too close. I don't understand why you're doing the most. You can love it, you can leave it. I'm singing nothing without it, yeah. Don't let them keep you down. What if I don't need it? There's something about it, and that just freaks me out.
Addiction was something Mac struggled with throughout his life, but there's more to him than just stories about drugs or his chart-topping albums. Behind all that was a Pittsburgh kid with an infectious smile and hustle for days. He and his friends would spend time goofing off around Pittsburgh, freestyling and making beats for fun in their parents' homes until they all realized the potential Mac Miller had, so much so that he got serious about his music at just 15 years old. Now, a new biography called Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller, is out, written by Paul Cantor. Paul writes in the book, "Know this, Mac Miller was a complex guy, a rapper who spent his life using his art to explore the space between his own madness and genius. All the while, he battled untamable forces inside him that were beyond his control. Now, we may not all be mad geniuses, but on that last note, I'm certain many can relate." Joining me now is Paul Cantor. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So before Mac Miller died, you met him a few times for work or through mutual acquaintances. Why was he the person that you wanted to write your first book about?
I think he was misunderstood at the end of his life. If you look at the last, 6 to 9 months, he had become a bit of a tabloid story. And then after he passed, you know, when people pass away in the way that he did, they sort of get reduced to the circumstances around their death. I was much more interested in his life. I knew, and I talk about this in the book, that, you know, he was a very passionate artist from day one. And a lot of people discovered him almost like after he passed away, but I knew that there was a lot more, you know, to him. I just kind of was like, what is the origin story here? Because the origin was as interesting to me as the finality. And that was kind of my goal and why I wanted to do it. I hadn't, you know, it was a thing that was kind of happening right in front of me. I'd read a lot of, press, that was happening around right before he passed away. The press was going one way and his life was going the other. So there was, you know, something interesting to that. And there was just like a lot of contradictions and a lot of mystery there. So I kind of got interested in trying to figure it out and going in and just like seeing what else was under the hood. But I also knew, like I said, that there was a, you know, a really deep person there. He was a striver, came pretty much from nowhere And I really just wanted to unpack that.
What do you think Mac Miller, as a musician, as an artist, did really well that really made him stand apart?
First and foremost, I think he was a great rapper. Beyond anything else, he was, you know, I think you see this in the book. He wanted to be considered a great MC. We talk a lot about that in the book, about what that means and what, you know, what goes into that, how that is perceived by other people, not just the person who's doing it, you know, but by the community itself, right? Which kind of polices itself, so to speak, right? You can be a great rapper, but if you're doing it and nobody knows, what does it mean, right? It's another thing to have Jay-Z or somebody say, you know, you're a great rapper, right? And so that's first and foremost. I think he was, you know, in an upper echelon of rappers, and I think his catalog reflects that. Second thing is he was a producer. He was very instrumental in the vision of his own albums and, you know, his mixtapes and pretty much all that he did. And there was tension, I think, sometimes between his vision and other people's vision, which the book unpacks. Some of that having to do with the commercial, you know, prospects or desires of the music industry and an audience and what they expect from you. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, I think, is evolution. This is the guy whose music at, you know, the end of his life sounds almost nothing like it does at the beginning of his life. There are certain elements that are still intact, and there are certain themes that recur like motifs in, you know, what he's talking about. But the music changes as he grows. And I don't think growth alone, you know, makes him unique because, you know, the Beatles don't sound anything like they did, in, you know, at the end of their shelf life as they did at the beginning. Does Michael Jackson, you know, that's just part of, you know, being an artist. But I do think that there was an unbelievable complexity to his, you know, music towards the end of his life. It's just, it was not there in the beginning. But it's also very simple too. Those three things, I think, if you can kind of isolate on them, you know, that makes him what he is.
My guest is Paul Cantor. We're talking about his new book, Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. It is out now. So I found it very interesting in the book. Chapter one is actually not about Mac. It's about Pittsburgh. It's a bit deep into the history of Pittsburgh, all through the Carnegies and all of the different barons. Why did you make this the starting off point to tell this man's story?
Well, I've been telling people this is kind of the only book where you can go from Andrew Carnegie to Ariana Grande. when we talk about rappers, right, we talk about all these social things, right, that influence who they are, where they come from. If Compton is a part of who Kendrick Lamar is, right, or Fayetteville, North Carolina is a part of, you know, where J. Cole is from, or Staten Island or Shaolin is where Wu-Tang is from, well, then Point Breeze, Pittsburgh, is where Mac Miller is from. Well, what does anybody know about Point Breeze? Well, turns out that most people don't know anything, you know, outside of that community. But when you go there, you can kind of talk to people and they'll sort of isolate on the type of community it is. And you see just certain aspects of it that are just like super interesting. And I started trying to understand like what the community was about. The more I learned, I started realizing, oh, Teddy Roosevelt is walking down the street. Now, if you would have told me, you know, a kid who grew up in Staten Island in a small condo, you know, that was the size of a bedroom, that the president of the United States had once walked down my block, I'm sure that would have done a lot to how I thought about myself and where I came from and what the people around me meant in my sense of community. So I really wanted to understand the neighborhood better. Pittsburgh is a fascinating city, beautiful city, by the way. Really, every time I went there, I was really like impressed with it. People are, you know, just super nice and very welcoming, and obviously very sports fanatics. I just kind of like, I could see that the neighborhoods around Point Breeze changed a lot. If you just went about 5 minutes, not even driving, I mean like walking, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, neighborhood would change drastically. And, you know, that in and of itself was interesting because, you know, there was, that's a suburban neighborhood that's actually in the city. It's surrounded by a huge park that's donated, or was, you know, basically built by Henry Clay Frick, right? Mm-hmm. And he has an album that's more or less about returning to that park, Blue Slide Park, all right? So there's this unbelievable sense of, you know, community and progressivism and liberalism that sort of seeps through there. And I think that there are elements of who those people were, even though they became, you know, robber barons and have a very conflicted, you know, history in the United States, depending on who you're talking to. I could see that that was sort of imbued as a value system, not just, you know, in Mac, but a lot of the people that were he was growing up with around there. And so, yeah, I was fascinated by that. Just as you, like I said, you would be fascinated to some degree or another to say, oh, Kendrick Lamar, he's this poet of the streets and he grew up around all these gangs and stuff. You know, it's the same thing.
It's sort of interesting, though, because Mac is from sort of a nice middle-class family. He's interfaith, went to Catholic school, but also Hebrew school, and he loved hip-hop. You know, a lot of kids fit this profile. But what made Mac pursue it seriously, and people take him seriously?
I think, they didn't really take him seriously. That's sort of the Rosetta Stone or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if that's the right term, but that's kind of the thing, right, is that they don't take him seriously because he does come from there, right? And there is a little bit of this thing of like, what hood are you from? You know, you're not even from a hood, right? You're from here. Now you combine that with the technology that is enabling kids to basically claim they're rappers but not really be from anywhere. And so you have this kid who's from nowhere. He's online, he's getting a, you know, fan base, but like in his own community, there isn't really a lot of respect because he doesn't have that like street credibility. And also he's a white guy, right? So, there's a lot kind of going on there. And I think that, yeah, his desire to be taken seriously, coming from that kind of place, definitely played a role in, you know, whatever it was he was dealing with early on in his career.
Let's listen to a clip of one of Mac's early songs, back when he went by the name Easy Mac, before he was Mac Miller. This is called Thanks for Coming Out. It's off his 2007 mixtape, But My Mackin' Ain't Easy. What should we listen for in this?
That song... Well, that's the song that I think closes the mixtape. I think he's just thanking people, right? And he's telling people what to expect. And I haven't listened to that one in a while.
Well, let's take a listen. We can talk about it on the other side.
Yeah, let's go for it.
We got time for one more. Yeah. All right. You at the back of the Mac. Yeah. Easy Mac raps looking sensational. Full of fools out their shoes like the 1st of April. I'm aiming low, with words guaranteed to make them fold. I'll be remembered next December, but your name will go. My name remains rhyme sent to your brain. Intentions are staying, these other cats resent and complain. My mind's betting insane till the lyrics are complete. Spitting fear in the ears of all those who compete, so I never skip a beat. The kid is swisher sweet, you can picture me cheesing when my album hits the street. With the words too sick to speak, so I spit it in my sleep. Counting sheep, I'm about to heat. Proving anybody wrong who is doubting me. They say, Malcolm, please get a new career. It appears that they fear who I'll be in a year. Cause I'm creating racket, making tracks up in the attic. See my life change after I heard Illmatic. It was drastic, automatic, rapping fantastic. I'm Jurassic, mic melts like plastic. I got the gift and you wish that you had it. So you study hip-hop and you read how to do's, thinking that it's helping but you learning how to lose. See, I was born gifted, lived together.
get lifted. If rapping ain't my life, then what is it?
So, Paul, you know, how did he use the internet to share his music and grow his fan base?
Well, now, right, a lot of people can just go on Instagram Live, right, and just kind of broadcast themselves. He was doing this at another time on something called Ustream, and that was kind of a precursor to the, you know, whatever technology exists right now. And he would just kind of hop online, and he would freestyle, and just freestyle, like people would just be holding up things up in the room, and he would kind of rap about it. And, you know, freestyling is an art form unto itself, and people who are good at that sometimes only remain good at that. They can do that, but they can't really make a song. And then you have people who can make a song who can't freestyle. But a freestyle takes hip hop literally back to its, you know, its core elements, which is, you know, improvisation, right, and being funny and entertaining a crowd. It's literally the definition of being an MC, right? So at an early age, he's kind of developing these skills, right, that are kind of fundamental to what it means to be a rapper that, frankly, a lot of rappers nowadays don't even do. You know, it's to be the center of things, and so that's how he was doing it. It was, you know, by going on Ustream, he was, you know, attracting fans almost from day one, because they would say, who's the white kid doing the freestyles, right? Mm-hmm. And they would say, you got to check this out. And they would tell their friends, hey, you know, he's on Ustream. Like, let's go watch it, right? But there's no business model there. That's like, there's nothing to it. It's just enthusiasm, and it's just drive, and it's just passion, and it's just hunger, and it's just a desire to express oneself in front of a crowd.
My guest is Paul Kantor. We're talking about his new book, Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. We'll have more with Paul after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. We're talking about the new book, Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. I'm speaking with its author, music journalist Paul Kantor, about the life of the, unfortunately short life, of the rapper and producer. So a big part of Mac's early story happens underneath Rostrum Records, which has been described as rap's last great independent label. What did the label mean to him? It's a Pittsburgh-based label. And then why did he leave?
Well, I think the label initially was like, they were all kids who went to the same high school. They went to Taylor Alderdice, and their first artist, Wiz Khalifa, was a Taylor Alderdice graduate. And Taylor Alderdice has a lot of, you know, iconic people that have graduated from there. So I think it was like important that he was around people who were kind of like him. They were, you know, white Jewish kids who were into hip hop, you know, and so I think there was a family element, and it was like they were kind of working with their little brother in a sense. And as to the circumstances around his leaving, I talk about it a little bit in the book. You know, I think there was an element of the contract itself was up. You know, I think it was, he had, was signed for like a number of years in which he was supposed to deliver, you know, a certain number of albums, and the, you know, it was over. And I think there was a little bit of, competition for, attention, with, it was a small label. The label is still around and they're still doing things, you know, but at the time it was a small label, and as many people on smaller labels, you know, do, they want resources, right? They want attention. They're saying, you know, give me X amount for this, give me X amount for that, because, you know, they want to have their vision come to life. So there was that element of it. I think the label, you know, they made great efforts to sort of curtail some of what was going on, you know, behind the scenes. They were concerned about it. And some of just the business model of the way the music business was at that time, which was very independent driven. You know, a lot of people don't remember, but in hip hop, in the music business 10 or 11 years ago, there really was no business model. The internet had more or less destroyed the music business. You know, now it's a healthy business again. So we just see big music festivals and stuff, but like none of that existed. There was a new circuit of like clubs and colleges and a younger audience that was kind of getting into it through the internet. And Mac was sort of at the forefront of that. Mm-hmm. And the label was as well, which I talk about in the book. You know, when him and like Wiz Khalifa, when these guys were going on the road, nobody had even been in these places, right? This was like a whole new thing that they were doing. But the model was like, you tour a lot, and that's kind of what makes your career, you know? And the recorded music aspect of it, because there was no streaming or anything yet, was sort of irrelevant. It was kind of an added bonus. You sold concert tickets, and you sold merch, right? Mm, T-shirts, yeah. Hats, whatever. That was the business, very independent, like band-centric type thing. But in order to do that, you have to tour relentlessly. And that type of touring can take a toll on you. And I think it did. And I think he was just looking for a change. He was like, I don't want to be a part of this type of model anymore. Right. I want to, you know, go to a label that, you know, is bigger. I don't have to put as much effort into this type of thing. They can kind of just push a button and get my song to the radio and so on and so forth. I mean, he had never really had, you know, a lot of radio success. So that was also part of it. Yeah.
As Mac Miller's career starts to take off, he moves to L.A. in a mansion in Studio City, where he starts to collaborate with more artists. He establishes a home studio known as The Sanctuary. How did his time in L.A. affect his mental health?
I can't be in his head, so I don't know for sure. I try to, you know, deduce that from other people. I think that he had a bit of a roller coaster in L.A. in that time period, one of which was beyond his control. If you're touring for 2 or 3 years straight and then you stop, your mind is used to a roller coaster that's just not there anymore. You kind of isolate. He seemed to have isolated with the intention of making like the air quotes great rap album, which was watching movies with the sound off. It was like, I'm going to make an album that really proves to everyone that I'm a great artist and that I'm here to stay and I want my respect. So a lot of attention was kind of being devoted to that, less so to the touring. And I think when you just sort of fixate on something, that can kind of drive you crazy. And that was where a little bit of that madness starts coming into play. It's like, you want something so bad, and you go to great efforts to dig beneath the surface that, you know, you start digging and digging and trying to find more and more. And like the more you turn yourself inside out, mm-hmm. the crazier it gets, right? So that was, I think, what was happening in that period of time.
Mac Miller's 2014 mixtape Faces was made during this time in LA. It was just released on streaming platforms in October. I think we actually have a clip. So let's take a listen and we can talk about it on the other side.
If it was colors and shapes, the imaginary, instead of all of this weight that we have to carry, would you be able to breathe? If you could just find where that comfort resides, no distraction or movement that switch your mind, would you let them see?
So how does this album, this mixtape, represent the life Mac was leading at this point?
I think that mixtape, which a lot of people don't really remember, but it didn't really get much attention at the time. It came out and it really didn't make much of an impact. I think his fans latched onto it, mm-hmm. and people who were really into him connected with it. But it was a little bit of a sort of a last-ditch effort to say, you know, this is what I'm about. Yeah. It was very experimental. It was very stream of consciousness. It was... you know, very gonzo, as you can hear on it. So I think that, you know, mixtape, which I believe, to the best of my knowledge, he actually tried to get Rostrum to put out. And I don't think that the label, you know, wanted to put it out. And so he just put it out for free, right? He had a website, oldjewish.com. It was like he was taking a thing that was, you know, kind of a joke, right? Which is, you know, the sort of old Jewish stereotype, and you know, he's a half Jewish person, right? Mm-hmm. And he was kind of playing it up for laughs. He did merch, you know, he shot a video. His mom was, I think, serving food at the video shoot. You know, so he was kind of like taking something that was a pretty low moment in terms of like his life and putting it into his art. And then that was kind of a model that sort of repeated itself in his life. Go low, go low, get the thing out of it that I need to get out of going low, and then come back high, right, and put it out. It's like a release, you know, and you would get the euphoria of the release, and you become addicted to that cycle, right? And that was also kind of something that I hope people could take from the book, that you could see that there was actually a little bit of a like I said, a motif that recurs, right?
Yeah.
I go low, and then I come back out, I go high, the euphoria comes, and then I got to do this all over again.
My guest is Paul Kantor, music journalist. The name of his book is Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. We should mention, and you mentioned the book, that Mac Miller's estate and family didn't cooperate in making this book. You touch on it in your author's notes. And they've been vocal about opposing the publication of the book. Did you ever get a sense of why the family didn't want to see your book as something they wanted to participate in?
No. I didn't.
You didn't. When people did talk to you, why did they say they would talk to you? Because you did, obviously you spoke with people who were close to him, just not the family.
I think people thought it was a good idea. You know, before I started on it, I went and I asked people how they felt about it. Because I would never start on a project such as this without having some sense that it was, I've never reported on somebody, you know, like without their knowledge or anything like that. So I would never do something that, you know, crossed any type of boundary. So I went to people that I knew that were close to him, and I asked them how they felt about it. Actually, wasn't really even, you know, it was more like, how would you feel? And they were like, this is a great idea. Two or three things that jumped out of me were he didn't live his life, you know, the way he did to not have somebody write it down. Another person told me, you know, his story belongs to the world, right? And, you know, you got to go out there and tell it. And then the third thing was like, there was an understanding that the, you know, evolution of knowledge and information is how, you know, things sort of exist, right? Like you don't get anywhere by closing the loop. You know information builds upon itself, and so that was kind of what I was trying to do. It was like, you know, yeah, like he did live a really interesting life. There was a lot going on there, and you know, what are we really doing here? Like you know, so that's kind of what I went into it with. But I never really got an understanding of what was going on behind the scenes.
The name of the book is Most Dope, The Extraordinary Life of Mac Miller. It's out now. I've been speaking with its author, music journalist Paul Kantor. Paul, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.